funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
3 weeks ago, in a brief reprieve from banner headlines about American primary elections, the world thrilled to the story of Inky the Octopus. This one-time resident of New Zealand's National Aquarium went full Shawshank, stealing through a gap in the top of his tank when no human keepers were about, slithering across the room, and then headed down a 164-foot drainpipe that emptied him conveniently into Hawke's Bay and presumably to freedom. After a story like that, it's very hard to believe Inky was operating simply by instinct. So what's to say other animals are not significantly smarter than we thought? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. For much of the history of modern science, researchers defined intelligence according to what we humans could do. We were the brilliant ones, while the other beings who shared our world were just reacting instinctively to what happened in the moment. Unless we were too dense to give them due credit for their ability to survive, think, plan, remember, and communicate? Could be. Franz Dewaal is working to change that. He is C.H. Candler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Franz, welcome back to Think.
I'm happy to be here.
You open the book with a story of Franja, this chimp living in a Dutch zoo, and she seems to have made a plan to stay cozy outside on a cold day.
Yeah, so this happened at the zoo that I worked in the Netherlands, and the fall was coming and weather was getting colder. And she collected all her straw from her cage to take outside, which by itself is not really so special. But she did it while she was inside at a very nice temperature. And so the only way to explain that is that she extrapolated from the day before or the days before where it was cold, to assuming that it was going to be cold again. So we're very interested in this kind of thing where animals think ahead. And there's people now who do experiments on for example, you may give a chimpanzee a tool that he can only use 12 hours later, and you give them a choice between an apple now and a tool that you can use 12 hours later to get something else. And the chimp will, chimps and orangutans, they will wait. They will take the tool, and they will wait with that tool till they can use it. And so we're doing all these studies, which actually demonstrate that animals are not captive of the present. It's always assumed that animals live only in the present, but there's now lots of evidence that they plan ahead for the future.
Why have we been so reluctant for so long to really see animal intelligence for what it is? What was the mistake we made in comparing what they could do with what we could do?
Yeah, I think in the previous century you had sort of two schools. One is the biologists and the ethologists in Europe, and I'm a product of that. And we assumed instincts, basically. Everything that animals did was adaptive and instinctive. And then you had the school in the U.S., which was the behaviorists, so more the Skinner type, Skinner box and so on. So they put rats or pigeons in a small box with a lever that they can press, and they can get rewards for that. And they believe that everything animals did was very basic learning processes. And neither school felt that there was more complexity than that. And it's only in the last 25 years or so that we have a new generation of students of animal behavior who doesn't believe everything can be reduced to very simple learning or to instinct, and that there's much more going on in the heads of animals. And they're testing them more on their terms and not in these little boxes, but they observe them in the wild, and they set up experiments that are much more complex. And as a result, we now have a view that animals actually are much smarter than we think.
Part of the problem before was giving them the kinds of tests that made no sense. So, for example, there's really no point in figuring out whether a squirrel can count because squirrels don't need to count. So why would they evolve that ability?
Yeah, that is, we're very anthropocentric. We're very human-centric. So we take things that we are good at, like language or technology. We're very good at these things. And then we see what animals can do with that. And sometimes they do better, sometimes they do worse. And of course, in general, we like to be on top, so we want to be the ones who do best on these tasks. And if we don't, and that happens occasionally, that an animal does actually better than the humans, then we get very upset, because that's not supposed to happen. But why not test animals on the things that they are good at? So, for example, bats, they can orient in the dark. They can catch insects in the dark by echolocation. Now, you may think that that is simple, but actually echolocation, if you ever ask an airplane pilot, echolocation, they use something similar, the radar, is a very complex process. And so the bat has a lot of its brain is devoted to processing the information, to calculating its own trajectory and the prey's trajectory and correcting for the two of them. So it's a very complex task, but since we don't do any of that and we cannot really relate to it, we sort of ignore it. We think it's not that important. But it's actually for the bat, it's of course tremendously important.
So what do we do with this debate over anthropomorphism, which is giving human characteristics to animals? We can look at an animal and recognize behaviors that seem to resemble our own for a while, and I gather you were probably educated to avoid this. It was thought to be kind of a bias and a weakness in research.
Yeah, so when I first discovered that chimpanzees embrace and kiss each other after fights, so two chimps have a fight, 10 minutes later, one walks up to the other, and all of a sudden they embrace each other, and then they groom each other. And I'd seen this many times, and I called it reconciliation. But people would say you shouldn't call it reconciliation because that's anthropomorphism, and you should use a different word. So they proposed post-conflict contact. Now, I'm very opposed to that in the sense that a chimpanzee is – humans and chimpanzees are very closely related. If you would have a horse and a zebra, let's say, who behave in similar ways and have similar behavior patterns, you would, of course, use the same language for the two of them because a horse and a zebra are very closely connected to each other. The same is true for a human and chimp. Our distance in terms of genetics and evolution is not much greater. And so if a chimpanzee laughs when you tickle it, you should call it laughing. And so they make these sounds like type sounds. It sounds like laughing, and it's very hard for us not to laugh when we tickle them because it is really a very similar behavior. And so instead of calling it vocalized panting or whatever people can come up with as a euphemism, I think you need to use human terminology for chimpanzees because everything they do is so similar to what we do. Now, if you go a bit more distant, if you watch birds or fish or whatever, then you have to become more careful because obviously that distance creates also differences of how these behaviors come about. And so it is with closely related animals that anthropomorphism is actually a help, I think. With animals a bit more distant, like dogs and cats, people anthropomorphize them all the time, of course. We have to be a bit more careful, but I would say that many of the basic emotions that we have, like, let's say, attachment and love or hate and territoriality or all these basic emotions that we have, we can see in our pets and we can recognize them.
How can we tell the difference in animals between behaviors that are instinctive and those that are learned based on experience or based on being part of a group?
Well, I think all behavior is a combination of the two. And that's true for humans also, actually, is that we don't have purely learned behavior. We may have a few, but even language, we learn language when we're young, but we have a special capacity to learn language. It's a human inborn capacity that we have. And so there's a language instinct, basically, that we fill in during our development with the language that surrounds us. And so all behavior in humans and animals is a combination of the two. And so, for example, let's say echolocation in bats, which I mentioned before, there's an instinctive side to it in the sense that there's inborn capacities to do this, but they also have to learn how to do this. And so all of these things, are, even the flight of birds, you know, if you've ever raised a young bird, you know that they have to learn to fly. So flight is, of course, an instinctive behavior in the bird. They have wings to do it, after all. But they still have to learn to fly and especially to land. Young birds are not good at landing, and they have to learn all of that.
Franz, birds fly for transportation. Sometimes they fly so that they can get food or even hunt. I have to say, though, and I'm sure you've seen this too, there are times when you will see a bird gliding around on a beautiful day, and it really looks like they are out there just because it feels good. Is that possible?
Well, that's maybe how you see it, and because you would maybe feel very good. I think we humans are a little bit jealous of birds in that regard. But, you know, if one of these turkey vultures that you have in Texas, no doubt, sails around, they're actually waiting to pick up some scent of some dead animal. And so they're moving about, and as soon as they smell that, they're going to zoom in on it and get there. And so even when animals fly around like that, they're usually waiting for the right opportunity to get a meal, I suppose.
We've all observed animals greeting one another, whether it's for the first time ever or for the thousandth time. Might they also say goodbye to one another before they part?
I think there's very few animals who do. So in chimpanzees, I've observed that. So in chimpanzees, we had, for example, a female chimp who lived on an island in a zoo, and we had to call her out every day because she was raising a baby, actually, on the bottle. So she had adopted the baby chimp, and since she didn't have milk of her own, we gave her a bottle, and she would then give the bottle to the baby. So that was already remarkable enough. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, we would have to call her out of the group every day in the middle of the day. And we started noticing after a while that, yes, she would come out, but she would also visit important members of the group who were spread out over the island. She would visit the alpha male, and she would visit the alpha female, who was her best friend, and she would visit a few of them and give them a kiss, and if they were asleep, she would wake them up to give the kiss, and then she would walk into the building where we called her. So she was basically saying goodbye, and there's several other observations of that. But I think in order to say goodbye, you have to, again, have that plan ahead capacity. And that's why most animals that you have, let's say your cats or your dogs, I don't think they are good at the goodbye part. They're good at the hello part, but not the goodbye part.
What do we know about what's going on in the brains of animals when they are having these kinds of exchanges that we humans might have? Is the same sort of activity taking place within their brains?
Sometimes we know. So, for example, there was a time where people assumed that only humans recognize faces. And strangely enough, they had tested chimpanzees not on chimp faces but on human faces. And they were not good at it. And I talked with the researchers who did that work, and I said, why did you use human faces? And they said, well, humans are so different one from the other that if they cannot tell those apart, then they're going to have trouble with their own faces as well. And it actually turned out when we started testing chimps on chimp faces, they were excellent at it. So for a chimp face is very different than a human face. And so that's what we found, that capacity. Now, when after the chimps, there were monkeys. Chimps are, of course, not monkeys. Chimps are apes. So after the chimps came the monkeys who recognized faces. And now we even have data on sheep who recognize faces.
Wow.
And we also know from the neuroscience behind it now that they do it in the same way as we do it. The same areas of the brain are involved when chimpanzees recognize faces than when we do, meaning that the process behind it is very similar.
Frans de Waal is my guest. He's director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, and he's author of a new book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frans de Waal, who is C.H. Candler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? If you've got a question, you can send it to us by emailing think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Frans, most of the time when animals vocalize, the sounds they make do not sound to us anything like words. What have we learned about the fact that some can indeed communicate specific ideas to one another using sounds that they make?
Well, there's lots of attempts to teach language to apes, for example, human language. I always think that we do better in focusing on their natural communication, and it can indeed be very complex. So, for example, dolphins have very complex underwater sounds. Chimpanzees have very complex call system and gestures and facial expressions. And there are certain species, like certain monkeys, that have specialized calls for specific predators. And so they not just communicate to each other like, watch out, there's a predator, but they also communicate what kind. Is it an eagle? Is it a snake? Is it a leopard? They have different calls for that. And so when that was discovered, it started to resemble a little bit human language because they seem to have words for certain outside dangers.
What can you discover by studying different populations of animals in such different locations that they might even have different cultures?
Yeah, the culture concept has gotten quite big. This started in Japan with the Japanese scientists. I think the West was not ready for it because there's anthropologists in the West who said culture is what makes us human, which means that there's no room for animal culture. But the Japanese scientists discovered on one of their populations of monkeys that they started washing potatoes. So this was on a small island in Japan, which I visited several times, where the monkeys would get potatoes from the researchers, and they would, a young female was the one who started it. She would run with the potato to a little pool of water and start cleaning it before eating it. And as soon as she did that, her peers started following. And so within a year, I think, the whole group was doing this behavior all the time. And so that was the first tradition in the species. And the Japanese scientists said we have animal culture. And after that, people have found it in so many animals. And so, for example, in chimpanzees, it's much more complex even because chimpanzees in Africa, they have maybe 50 different patterns that vary from group to group, which are learned from one from the other. We have done experiments at the Yerkes Primate Center on how well chimpanzees can learn from each other. And actually, they're very good imitators. And so there's good data to support the idea that animals have cultural differences.
Are social animals likely to be more intelligent than those that don't have a kind of group identity?
Well, I know that the dog owners think that the dogs are smarter than the cats, and the cats are solitary hunters. Hmm. Now, I'm not convinced that dogs are smart. Dogs are more obedient. And of course, we humans, we get fooled by that. We think, well, that's really smart because they do what we tell them to do. And the cats couldn't care less. So I think social intelligence is a sort of special category. And I'm very fond of it, of course, because I started my career with a book called Chimpanzee Politics, which was all and actually in this day and age in the U.S., there's a lot of chimpanzee politics in my mind going on here. Well, let's not get into that, but
that's
certainly
a different
social
hour.
Intelligence. Yeah, that would be another hour. But chimpanzees, the reason I talk of politics in chimps is that an alpha male cannot be alpha male without support of a substantial part of the community. And so it's a bit like a democratic process almost, in the sense that just by being big and strong, that doesn't make you an alpha male because there's too many individuals who will be objecting to that. And so you have to have supporters. Usually in a chimp community, that means you have to have some high-ranking males who help you, and you have to have some high-ranking females who help you. And so this is the reason that male chimpanzees are very active when they try to become the alpha male. They're very active being social. They groom everyone. They share food with everyone. They tickle the babies of the females because that's what the females like to see. And so they do a lot of things in order to become the dominant male. And it is really like a political process. And that takes intelligence. That takes some planning capacities and some strategizing. And there's now increasingly evidence for that kind of social skills, not just in the chimpanzees, but in many other animals as well.
And it's not like, Franz, that they are simply, you know, giving a bunch of fruit to everybody who might support them as alpha male. They are, as you've described it, they have a sense of what the females will want to see and what the, you know, maybe older members of the group will want to see. They have, it sounds like, a sense of what other people are thinking, other chimps are thinking.
Yeah, there is some evidence. This is called theory of mind. Do you know what somebody else knows? Do you have an understanding of what others know and want and feel and so on. And the study of theory of mind, which is now very big in child research, actually, this started with chimpanzees, and it started actually with Emil Menzel. He worked in Texas, but I'm not sure anymore where. I think it was San Antonio or something. He worked in Texas, and he had a big enclosure, and he would take a juvenile chimpanzee out into the enclosure by the hand, and he would show him where a snake was hidden, like a fake snake, or where food was hidden. And then he would take that chimp back to a building where a whole bunch of other chimps were, and he would release them all together. So now we had the situation of, let's say, six chimpanzees entering that enclosure, only one of whom knew where the food was hidden. And then he would see, did the others pick up on that? Did the others react differently, for example, when one of them knew food versus the fake snake? And would the other one lead them away or towards the food? And actually, the smart chimps, they developed a strategy of leading everyone astray and leading all these other chimps to a place where there was basically nothing and then run to the food to pick it up quickly for themselves. Hmm. So he described all these things as sort of mind games that were going on between chimps. And out of that came the field of theory of mind, which is now very big, and there's quite a bit of evidence in large-brained animals like, let's say, crows and chimpanzees, that they have some theory of mind. And there's, of course, a lot of child research going on, because it's one of the main measures we use in children of their cognitive development nowadays.
What do we know about chimps' willingness to do a solid for some other chimp? Like, if it doesn't cost them anything, are they willing to help somebody else out?
Yeah, we did experiments on that. We did an experiment where they could exchange tokens of different color with us, and they would get food for each time they gave us a token, they would get food. But the interesting thing is that one color would only feed themselves and the other color would feed themselves plus a partner who was sitting next to them. And the chimps were very, very willing. They actually chose that the one that fed both of them. We called that the pro-social token. They picked that far more often than the selfies token, which only fed themselves. And so chimps actually do take into account the well-being of somebody else, which was one of those many things that was claimed to be uniquely human. In my lifetime, I've seen probably 25 different claims coming by of things that only humans can do. And 5 years later, we say, well, actually, chimps can do it too, or dolphins can do it too. And this has happened so often that's why in the book I ask for a moratorium on that kind of claims. I feel we need to stop making uninformed claims about uniquely human features, because they're really very few. The only one that I recognize is language. That's the only one I really recognize. And for the rest, I would say it's all basically flimsy and disprovable.
Without the kind of language that we recognize with the, you know, great complexities that human language has, what can we surmise about cognition in animals in terms of like memories? What form, you know, our memories are so often sort of processed through language or understood through that lens. You know, if I leave my dog home all afternoon, is she thinking about playing tennis ball, you know, throwing the tennis ball with me last night?
Yeah, well, there's a kind of memory which is called episodic memory, which is that you can remember precise details of an event way back. So, for example, if I ask you about, let's say, the wedding of your sister or something, you can come up with very precise details because you have an episodic memory, as it is called. Mm-hmm. And it was long assumed that that required language, and that was a reason why animals would not have that kind of memory. But now studies on both crows, so large-brained birds, and primates like chimpanzees, have shown that you can present them as a situation that they have only seen, let's say, 5 years ago. They've seen the specifics of that situation. And you present them now with the same situation without telling them that it is about that previous event. And they have a very precise memory of what happened then and there. And so people have been testing this out. The sort of specific memories that we associate with language are present in some large-brained animals.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Shane in Denton. Hi, Shane.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Sure.
My question was, do you think it's hard for humans to understand how smart animals are, because a majority of us believe or are taught that humans are the smartest. And would you say that because we think that way, that that's also because of our survival? If we think that we're the smartest, we will be the smartest.
Yeah. Well, you're right. There's a lot of prejudice. We are sort of indoctrinated in this regard. It's like we have soul. It's a religious thing. We have souls. Animals don't have souls. We are smart. Animals are sort of instinct machines. So we're indoctrinated that that's the case. And that's why for the longest time we did not find much intelligence in animals. Because if you have already a preconception that they don't, what are you going to find? And so people really didn't find very much. And it's only in the last 25 years that we have a new generation of scientists who is not really bothered by that indoctrination so much and is looking beyond things and is presenting animals with much more challenging problems than they used to get and documenting that many of them are actually very good at it. And I think another issue is that we always tested animals on things that we are good at. We didn't necessarily take into account what kind of lives do they have, what is important to them, what are they good at. So you have certain birds, for example, who can remember 10,000 seeds that they have hidden in the fall, and in the spring they pick them all up. So that's a sort of memory that we cannot even relate to. And it is learning-based, and so it is an intelligent act, basically. But we ignore that kind of things if we don't test them the right way.
There is a lot packed into our human brains, and certainly we're the only creatures who have deliberately changed, really, the very shape of the planet. Is it our long childhoods that mean that we have a range of cognitive abilities that exist in other animals, but maybe to smaller degrees?
We have big brains. Our brains are not different from, let's say, a monkey brain. Mm. And actually, the whole push of looking at continuities comes to a large degree from neuroscientists, because they realize that the rat brain and the monkey brain and the human brain are all very similar in many ways. So our brain is bigger and more powerful. It's not bigger than all the animals, and so that's another issue, is that at some point, 5 years ago, neuroscientists said, let's dispense of the size of the brain. Let's not look at the size and the weight. Let's just count the neurons. And that's going to be our measure of intelligence. And since it was assumed that humans had the most neurons, everyone was very happy with that conclusion. Then 2 years ago, it was found that actually the elephant has a very big brain and has actually 3 times more neurons than we do. And now everyone is sort of in limbo. Now we don't know what to do anymore with the neuron count, because we would have to admit that the elephant should be smarter than us. And so we always go through these kind of motions. My guess is that animals with very large brains, like elephants and crows and chimpanzees and so on, they can solve a very wide range of problems. There are certain things that we do that they cannot do, I'm sure. But we have totally underestimated what they're capable of. And also because many of the scientists who work on intelligence, they worked with rats and pigeons, which are not really very large-brained creatures. And so they worked with small-brained animals.
Crows can hold a grudge.
Crows are very remarkable. Crows use tools. They even make tools, which used to be, that's another one that used to be considered uniquely human, is that they can fabricate a tool to make it suitable for the task that they do. The first one was Betty the Crow. Betty the Crow lived in Oxford in a laboratory, and she was given a straight piece of wire to extract something from a tube. And she was unable to do it. She worked on it, but she was unable. And then she took that piece of wire, metal wire, and she started bending it till she had a hook. And then with the hook, she could get that thing out of the tube. And so she was basically making tools.
Wow. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. And in terms of holding a grudge, there are crows who have, like, recognized people who have banded them and that sort of thing and gone out for
them? Yeah, so they did an experiment where they put masks on people and some of these people would capture crows and then release them after that. But each time that mask would be visible on campus, this was a university campus, someone would walk around with that mask. The crows would be yelling at them and insulting them, and they were very angry at them. And so the crows remembered that particular human face that was on the mask. And people who had not done anything, they were not bothered by them.
We have a coworker here who, for a couple of years running, every time he would walk out to our parking lot, would be attacked by this particular mockingbird that didn't seem to bother anybody else. And I'm sure he never did anything to the bird, but I wonder if somehow that bird associated him with something that upset it, or is this just a fluke?
No, my guess would be that this person had gotten close to the nest or something at some point, or done something that the bird was not pleased by, you know, even if it was unintentional.
We're speaking this hour with Franz de Waal. He is C.H. Candler, professor in the psychology department at Emory University and director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Franz de Waal, director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and professor in the psychology department at Emory University. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Franz, there are these classic tests to understand whether or not animals recognize themselves in a mirror. You call yourself a gradualist with regard to using mirror tests as a sign of a certain kind of intelligence, possessing that intelligence or not.
Yeah, so the standard view of some people is that if you pass the mirror test, meaning that you put a mark on an animal or a child, for that matter, that they cannot see without the mirror. You put them in front of a mirror. Do they touch that mark? Meaning that they connect their reflection with their own body. That's the mark test. And there are some people who believe that if you can do that, you have self-awareness. If you cannot do that, you don't have self-awareness. So they're very absolute in this. But we see in the animal kingdom a lot of graduation. So, chimpanzees recognize themselves in the mirror, just like we do. Bonobos do. All the apes do. Elephants do. Dolphins do. But it is a very limited set of animals who can do this. But we see all this gradation. We see animals who are not fooled by the mirror necessarily. So your average dog and cat, you can keep a mirror in the home because they learn very quickly when they're a puppy or a kitten, they learn very quickly to ignore the mirror image. They don't keep attacking it like a songbird. Some songbirds, they keep attacking the mirror image till they die, basically. So there are animals who are fooled by the mirror, like a fish and some small birds. The animals who are not fooled, like, and the animals who fully recognize themselves. And so that's why I call myself a gradualist. I don't think animals who fail the mirror test are necessarily unaware of themselves. They have to have some self-awareness when they fly around or when they jump from branch to branch. They have to have some understanding of their own body in relation to the environment. But there's only a handful of species that recognizes itself.
Let's go to the phones now. 800-933-5372. We have Bruce on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could commentate on whether the comparison between farm animals like cows, chickens, goats, pigs, compared to wilder animals, their intelligence. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually in the middle of that debate with the dogs and the wolves. So the dogs are domesticated, the wolves are not domesticated. The wolves have larger brains, I assume, than the dogs do. And so you would assume that a wolf is actually smarter than most dogs. But initially, dogs were tested in the laboratory to see how well they follow pointing. So there would be a human standing there, point at one bucket or point at another bucket, and in the bucket could be food or no food, and to see what the dogs would do. And dogs pay close attention to where humans point. Then the same was done with wolves, and the wolves paid absolutely no attention. The same thing has been done with chimps, and chimps are moderately, they're not very great at paying attention. And so they concluded from this that dogs must be especially smart, and that maybe we had induced a certain intelligence in the dogs until they raised wolves in the homes of people. So now the wolves had a lot of exposure to humans. They came in as puppies, and when they were adults, they were tested on the same bucket task. And the wolves were just as good as dogs. And so now it is down to the point where they say, well, it's not that dogs are smarter than wolves. It's that wolves are not used to people, and that's why they don't pay as close attention to them. And so we are in that debate at the moment. I think many farm animals have high levels of intelligence. They are mammals with large brains, most of them. Pigs have large brains. And so we're probably underestimating a lot of the intelligence of farm animals just as well.
Talk about animals working together to solve a problem. Like, how do you hunt for a seal that's hanging out on an ice floe if you're a whale?
Yeah, so that's probably the most complex cooperation in the animal kingdom is perhaps what the killer whales are doing. The killer whales notice by spy hopping, they stick their head out of the water and they see on an ice floe that there is a seal there and they cannot get to it. But they have a trick. They line up five or six of these whales in precise order. And how they communicate this and how they decide this, we really don't know. But they line up five or six perfectly ordered, and they swim very fast as a group towards the ice floe, making an enormous wave. And this wave goes over the floe, and the seal is washed off. And then, of course, they have the seal. And this kind of high cooperation, this was thought to be uniquely human. Another one that was uniquely human, you know, where we saw joint intentionality, it was called, and it was considered uniquely human. As I said, there are so many of these claims of what is uniquely human that we now have forgotten about because we keep disproving them. And what the killer whales are doing is truly remarkable.
What does all this research do to your moral belief with regard to the appropriateness of, say, raising animals strictly to kill and eat them?
Yeah, so I think this kind of research has moral implications. And you could also argue the reverse is that the reason we have kept animals dumb, so to speak, and said that they are just instinct machines is maybe to justify the way we treat them. And so I feel the treatment of animals is changing. We, for example, there's a movement against circuses, animals in circuses. There's a movement against killer whales in captivity. There's a movement against testing chimpanzees on biomedical research. And I'm very much involved in that. I'm part of the board of Chimphaven, where we receive a lot of chimpanzees that are not being used anymore in medical studies. And so we are seeing a movement where people are getting more concerned about how we treat animals. And the agricultural industry is actually, of course, those are by far the biggest numbers we're talking about. And I think that's going to change probably also under the influence of people who feel that we're not doing a good job on that.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Stephen on the line in Cleburne. Hi, Stephen.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Mr.
DeWall,
I'm kind of curious. Do you believe if animals have the capacity for irrational behavior or possibly irrational thought, things so typically associated with man, revenge, spite, but not necessarily negative?
Yeah, I'm not sure it needs to be negative, but whether they can reason to some degree. Let me give an example, an example that I use in the book. We once approached our chimpanzees at the zoo with a crate full of grapefruits. And, of course, normally you would expect them to get very excited about seeing all these fruits, but they were not. They were sort of, I don't know what they thought, that we were going to eat them or whatever. They were not particularly excited. Then we opened the door to their island, and we carried that heavy crate out there, two people of us, and we walked onto the island, and they couldn't see us. And when we came back with an empty crate because we had hidden the food on the grounds of the island. When we came back with the empty crate, the whole colony got extremely excited, and they started hooting and hollering and slapping each other on the back, and they were very happy and festive. And the only thing I could conclude is that they had deduced, and that's a process of reasoning right here, they had deduced that since we walked with the grapefruits onto the island and we came back with an empty crate, these things must still be there. Now, so that's one thing. And then the second thing that happened is that we had hidden the food, those fruits, under sand. And so you could only see a few yellow patches here and there. And then we released all those chimps onto the island. And they were very excited, of course, because they assumed, a rational assumption here, they assumed that the fruits must be on the island. They ran, all of them, 25 of them, they ran onto the island. And one of them, a male named Dandy, he ran over the exact spot where we had hidden the fruits. And he ran over it, and I would have sworn that he had not seen anything because he kept going. But an hour later, when everyone was sort of asleep and grooming each other and sitting around, Dandy snuck back to that place and dug up the fruits. He was a low-ranking male. If he had done that right away, he would probably have lost most of the fruits to somebody else. But he had waited till everyone was occupied and went back to the place. And so that kind of incidents, these are anecdotal parts, but there's lots of experiments in my book also where people have tested out these things, shows that reasoning and logic is not really limited to our species.
You've described, you know, sort of decent behavior by chimps, even in that token experiment you told us about. You do stop short before calling them moral creatures. Why is that?
Yeah, I've written about the evolution of morality, and I do think many of the tendencies that we have integrated into our moral systems can be found in them. So we do experiments on the sense of fairness. We do experiments on empathy and cooperation and pro-social behavior. So they have all these capacities and tendencies. But whether they put them together as a moral system the way we do, that's where I'm reluctant. Because we humans, we try to justify also our moral rules. And so we have big debates about, let's say, the death penalty or abortion or gay marriage. We have all these moral debates like, is this good or is this bad? And we try to come up with arguments pro and con. And that's, of course, not something that the chimps are doing. So the justification part behind human morality is not there, but many of the tendencies that we built into it are already there.
Let's go back to the phones. We have David on the line in Weatherford. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, wonderful. I think it's a very interesting session today, and I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are about kind of doing a comparison of humans to other species. And specifically, I'm kind of curious, you mentioned like language is one where humans are kind of sort of set apart right now. And I'm also curious about artificial clothing. So, you know, for example, I read an article about people in Russia back in 2012, how it was, you know, had record, you know, sub-zero temperatures there and, you know, other places where we live that, as humans, we just have to have clothing. And yet you see other creatures like, you know, the walrus, well, you know, they're perfectly fine in, you know, freezing cold water. And it just makes me wonder what kind of experiments have been done for animals using artificial clothing intentionally, whether it's seen as a fashion type of thing or whether it's seen as a necessity of some kind.
What do you know about that, Franz?
Yeah. Well, we humans are naked, so obviously we're interested in clothing. We have lost most of our hair, and fortunately for other animals, they have their hair still. And so the polar bear is not worried about clothing, I think, at this point. But there are the question is also if there's artificial clothing just for decoration. And that does occur. It's called self-decoration. And so, for example, in the field, chimpanzees have been observed to drape the skin of another animal, usually an animal that they have killed, to drape the skin around their neck and walk around with that. There's a very interesting observation that was in a sanctuary where one female chimpanzee stuck a whole bunch of grass in her ear and walked around the whole day with that grass. And this became a sort of fashion trend because very soon other females started doing the same thing. And so that is, again, some sort of cultural phenomenon where they pick up a habit from each other. And so these things have happened. And so self-decoration is something you can find. You can find it in some birds who decorate themselves. Yeah, these things happen.
What kind of pets do you have at home, if any?
I have cats and I have a lot of fish. Strangely enough, even though I'm a primatologist, I'm very fond of fish. And I think the fish is another animal that is underestimated. Fish are actually very interesting animals.
And do you feel like you have a relationship to the chimps that you work with, the primates that you work with and study? Like, do they all completely feel like individuals to you?
Yeah, they're all individually recognized. They have all names. We call them by their name if we want to test them because they live in a group. They live in a sort of grassy enclosure, and we call them out by name. And they know each other's names even. That's maybe different from most animals. You can ask one chimp to get you another one because they know each other's names. And, we have personalized relationships. There are certain chimps that I've known all my life. When I came to Emory, that's like 25 years ago. So I knew them as a baby and I know them as an adult. And so, yeah, that creates, of course, a bond with them.
Frans de Waal is director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and author of the new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Frans, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for making this time for us.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our assistant producer is Samantha Guzman, associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.